Regarding the motions to strike, let me first take up the report prepared for the State of Nevada Public Utilities Commission that's attached to Dr. Mulvaney's testimony. I believe you stated, Ms. Roberts, that this is being offered not for the truth of the matters asserted in the report, but to demonstrate the existence of the report. Do I have that right?
That's correct.
So with that limitation, we will receive it. The response that Mr. Moskin referred to that is yet to be published or distributed, and that will not come into being until after our records closed, will not be received. And as to the office's objections, we very much value the order of our process for the preparation of testimony, direct testimony, rebuttal, surrebuttal. When a party skips that stage, it deprives other parties of their full opportunity to address it and challenge it. We're going to allow the material into the record, but we will view it in the light of those limitations. That is, the limitations that are created by the fact that it was introduced in surrebuttal rather than rebuttal. And as to the second and third objections, which relate to references in the testimony to other witnesses who are not specifically participating, references to the pre-filed testimony of other witnesses who are not specifically participating in this phase, that testimony is in the record, and the references are not going to be stricken. So it will be received. Dr. Mulvaney's testimony in those areas will be received as he prepared it. Is that, did I leave anything out? Any questions? So, Ms. Roberts.
Yes.
Back to you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Mulvaney, have you prepared a summary of your testimony that you can share with the commission?
Yes, I have.
Please proceed.
Okay, thank you. This will be concise, I hope. To evaluate Rocky Mountain Power's claim that NEM customers are not paying their fair share of costs of grid operations, I conducted an avoided cost analysis to understand how the costs of serving NEM customers compare to the benefits these same NEM customers provide. I developed a simulation model that accounts for hourly grid load, electricity costs, NEM electricity generation, and other variables. Results of my analysis, as described in my direct testimony, are that NEM facilities result in avoided cost of $1.4 million annually and $56.27 per NEM customer bill in the test year period. These results include only four benefits: avoided costs of energy generation, generation capacity value, transmission and distribution value, and an ancillary services value. As such, $1.4 million is likely an underestimate of the benefits because it does not include avoided costs that are typically included in such analyses, such as avoided environmental regulatory costs for criteria air pollutants and greenhouse gas emissions. From the period 2015 to 2040, NEM customer generation results in avoided costs of $139 million and substantial greenhouse gas emissions reductions. My recommendation to the Commission based on this analysis is to reject the proposed NEM charge because even a conservative estimate of the avoided costs attributable to NEM generation exceeds the company's estimate of the cost imposed on the grid by NEM customers. As such, the company has not shown that its fee is based on cost causation. I also showed that the original combined fixed charges increased economic payback times on distributed PV systems by nearly 1 year to 6.1 years. Economic payback time is a key metric used by customers to evaluate whether to invest in a photovoltaic system. A potential NEM customer who received a quote 1 month ago of a 9-year payback on their system might find tomorrow this payback to be as high as 15.1 years. This is based on a simple payback model, which did not include net present value in the final analysis, because when net present value is included in the model, it requires evaluating sensitivities to assumptions about the rate of finance, discount rate, inflation, and any increased NEM charge imposed in the future to account for inflation or fixed cost recovery. Overall, these fixed charges undermine the company's solar incentive by 21 to 38% and could ultimately deter such investments. I recognize that the charges have been modified since the start of the proceeding, and I'm happy to submit a new analysis for the record to update these impacts. The company alleges that NEM facilities negatively impact the Rocky Mountain Power electricity system by causing increased wear on equipment. My direct and surrebuttal testimonies explain why I believe the company's claims of increased wear are incorrect and not based on empirical evidence. My surrebuttal testimony also clarifies misinterpretations of my avoided cost analysis, some of which arise from confusion about the differences between avoided cost analysis, cost-benefit analysis, and ratepayer impact analysis. This suggests this issue deserves a separate, dedicated docket to explore these issues in greater detail with a more common understanding of the various tools to assess the costs and benefits from NEM customers. My reading of the company's rebuttals and surrebuttals has not changed my recommendations to the commission. And that concludes my summary.
Thank you.
Dr. Mulvaney is available for cross-examination.
Thank you. Mr. Moskin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Dr. Mulvaney.
Good afternoon. Nice to meet you.
I think that we can be relatively brief, and to try and accommodate that, I'm going to try and just lay a tiny bit of background where I think we're in agreement to highlight where we have differences. You agree with me, do you not, that in Utah, certain fixed costs are recovered by the utility through volumetric energy charges that are passed on to customers. You agree with that?
That's what I understand from Ms. Stewart's testimony.
And among those costs are distribution facility costs. Is that correct?
Sure.
Okay. And you agree, do you not, that under the current rate structure in Utah, taken as a whole, net metering customers shift some of those costs to non-net metered customers?
Which costs?
The fixed costs. Any of those costs that we just talked about that are recovered through volumetric energy charges.
You can restate it the original way. I'm sorry. Can you repeat that?
I think I said words to the effect of taken as a whole, net meter customers shift some costs to non-net meter customers.
I would disagree with that, taken as a whole.
Let me put it this way. Isn't it the position that you've taken in your testimony that's been filed that while you acknowledge that there are costs shifted, you contend that the benefits provided by net meter customers outweigh the costs that are shifted?
I would agree that, I'm sorry, can you repeat that one more time? I just want to make sure I understand the question.
I understand from your testimony that you have taken the position, yes, we recognize that there are some costs being shifted, however, the benefits exceed those costs that are shifted.
Yes.
So I'm just trying to establish the baseline. We don't need to argue about whether there is a cost shift. It's really a focus on the benefits, if that makes sense.
My testimony, yes, is focused on the benefits.
Okay.
Correct.
So there's not a dispute. There is some cost shift, but the question becomes, what's the value of the benefits provided by the net meter customers?
Right. An avoided cost analysis is purely looking at benefits.
Okay. Thank you. So you prepare this cost-benefit analysis that you talked about, and on page 22 of your direct is where we find Well, there are several charts, but on page 22, there is one of the figures, a bar chart where you kind of show the incremental parts of the benefits that you've calculated in your studies. Is that correct?
For the test year, yes.
Okay. Yes, for the test period.
Right.
Now, looking at this, I see that if math serves correct, of the approximate $1.4 million benefit of avoided costs that you've calculated, by far the majority, in fact, over 80%, comes from avoided cost of energy.
That's correct.
And you concede in your filings, don't you, that the value of that benefit is going to vary based on how you define it. What your input is going to determine the output. Isn't that correct?
For the particular line item, the avoided cost of energy?
The question probably holds for any of them, but yeah, in this case, I was talking about avoided cost of energy, but the question probably is the same without regard.
Right. What's the question?
Well, here, I guess I'll refer to your own testimony. On page 10 of your testimony, starting at line 20, you state, for example, the choice of electricity generating unit can drive the outputs of the avoided cost model.
That's correct.
So my point is, if you're going to do an analysis of what this benefit is, you can vary or change your result depending on what input you put in to the equation, right?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. And in fact, I have to concede you with candor make that same point in other places in your testimony, where, in fact, page 9, going over to page 10, you ask, the question is, how large are the avoided costs? The answer usually resides in the assumptions about how to value these resources, right?
I'm sorry, I'm not finding that. In which lines and page are you talking about?
The very last line of page 9.
Oh, yes.
Line 30.
Yes.
Right? So the point is, if you wanted, when I say you, if anyone was performing this kind of analysis, they could target a particular result based on what they determine we're going to value. We're going to assign numbers to these categories. By manipulating the inputs, you can focus the output, correct?
I wouldn't put it that way. I would put it the way I describe it in the testimony.
Well, okay, so I mean, I guess I don't see the distinction. You say, for instance, using specifics, not generic hypotheticals, in your specific case, you indicate that on the avoided energy cost analysis, by choosing which electricity generating unit you put into the model is going to determine what the output, what the result is, correct?
Correct, and that's why we show, let me see if I can find it, on page number 21. I'm sorry, that's not it. Page number 25, we looked at the various natural gas plants in that the utility owns,
right,
for avoided costs, and we took an average of those because we actually weren't sure which is the marginal unit, and that seems to vary at different times of the year based on the system capacity. So we took an average between the natural gas fleet that could be used to provide that.
Right. But what's interesting is, as you pointed out, you went straight to a natural gas plant and you averaged those, but you didn't allow in your result here for anything other than a natural gas plant to be the avoided facility. Is that correct?
That's correct, because usually in these avoided cost determinations, the plant that will come offline will be a thermal plant that's running inefficiently and costs the most.
Okay.
And usually hydropower or other resources that might be available, if they're inexpensive, will be running in base load.
Okay. So in the work papers that you provided with your materials, In one of the papers, you had a drop-down box where you could change whether it was a gas plant, a coal plant, or some kind of step-down. I can't remember the
correct
word.
Yeah, our model's built to evaluate various
right.
Generation scenarios.
And with the gas plant that you selected of the three choices that your work papers had of your model, again, the gas plant had an approximate 5 cents per kilowatt hour as being the avoided cost benefit. But isn't it true that if you had inputted a coal plant, that that would drop from 5 to approximately 1.9 cents?
I'd have to look at the, I don't remember, that model has millions of cells, so I'm not sure exactly. Okay. But, I mean, in principle, yes, we could have chosen a coal plant if that's okay. what you're asking.
And so if you don't recall whether it's exactly 1.9 or 1.6 or what it was, would you agree with me at least conceptually that the benefit that you're showing here as far as the value being provided by the net metered customer, since 80% of it is avoided energy costs, and if the coal number, if you subject to check, take my word for it, is 1.9, is less than half of the 5 cents that is the gas number, half of that number, or more than half of it, could just go away by you selecting a different input model or a different input factor, right?
Well, I think the analysis always could be improved with collaboration with the utility and better understanding of, you know, what is the marginal unit at any time. So I don't know if that answers your question, but yes, we could always improve the assumptions. But from my understanding, the natural gas plants are an appropriate resource to use for this.
Okay. Let's quickly make sure that I understand then, when you concede at the beginning that there are costs that are shifted, but again, the contention is the benefits outweigh the costs, you understand that in this jurisdiction, net metered customers are allowed to export excess generation back onto the grid, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And they receive a retail credit for any excess power they put back on.
That's my understanding.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you would agree with me that those customers that are the net metered customers, that they use company distribution facilities, whether they're either importing or exporting power. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay. And you've already conceded that net metered customers, again, as a whole or as an average, don't pay all of the fixed costs for those distribution facilities. They shift some of those costs, correct?
My testimony doesn't speak to costs at all. I'm just looking at avoided costs.
Well, on page 6 of your testimony, beginning at line 20, when you say, in my testimony, I demonstrate that the benefits created by NEM customers for the entire system far exceed the amount of fixed costs that are not recovered. That's the cost that I'm talking about. You can see there are some costs that are not recovered from those net metered customers.
Right, and that's in reference to the costs that are being purported to be caused by NEM customers by the company.
Yes, okay, so we are saying the same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the other categories of benefits that you discuss in your analysis is called transmission and distribution.
Yes. Capacity. Transmission and distribution capacity.
Yes. And you come up with the value for this extra capacity that's brought onto those systems by virtue of the net meter customers.
Correct. Yes.
you would agree with me, would you not, that a net metered customer relies on the company's distribution system continually, do they not?
Of course, yes.
And so that if a net metered customer has distribution facilities that connect them to the grid, even if there was a theoretical point in time in which they were generating exactly the amount that they were using, so none's being imported or exported, they were just in harmony, those distribution facilities are still needed solely for serving that customer, the ones that go to that customer's property.
Yes.
So even if there was a hypothetical calculation that said there's some capacity on that specific line, there's really not anything the company can do with that line at the time because it's dedicated to that resource. Isn't that correct?
Right, but the value that we generate isn't just about the line. It's about other elements of the distribution system. And transmission and distribution system.
Right. Off the record for 1 minute with your permission.
Off the record.
Back on the record.
On the record.
All right. We have no further questions at this time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Jetter.
No questions from the division. Thank you.
Mr. Coleman.
I do have a few. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Dr. Mulvaney, in your... try to move that so I don't bump it. In your direct testimony, you present some a wide variety of study proposals that have been the subject of some discussion in the last few minutes. One of those.
Can you clarify what you mean by study proposals?
Studies on valuing the beneficial attributes of NEM installations. Sort of, again, on page 7 of your direct testimony. One of the studies that you refer to was conducted in the jurisdiction of Minnesota. And on line 14, you talk about how Minnesota went beyond the avoided cost approach to estimate a value of solar, taking into account other avoided costs that the public benefits, such as improved environmental quality and avoided healthcare costs. You're aware, are you not, that the Minnesota conducted those studies under legislative direction and the scope and breadth of benefits was set by the legislature?
Yeah, the intention of this was to talk about the various different ways that it can be valued.
And Minnesota did their approach pursuant to legislative guidance?
Sure, yes.
And
yes,
do you know if Utah's legislature has directed a similar scope and breadth of and definition of what a benefit is?
They've not defined the benefit as far as I'm aware,
okay.
But I think they have directed to do an analysis of costs and benefits. Benefits, of course, would be looked at from an avoided cost approach. So that's the purpose of me putting this in here.
One of the other examples that you provide is the California feed-in tariff and their scope and discussion of benefits of NEM installations. You feel like that's an appropriate analog or potential example for Utah to rely upon?
No, the intention of this is to, again, give an overview of all the different approaches that can be used in an avoided cost approach. I'm not necessarily recommending anything. I think that's up to the commission to specify through a collaborative process or through another docket.
Okay. One point of clarification and I apologize, but I think it's necessary. In sir rebuttal testimony, page 3, starting on line 16, you quote Mr. Gimbel, and your sentence reads in its entirety, quote, "In his rebuttal testimony, Mr. Gimbel conveys OCS's recommendation that, quote, the commission open a new docket to explore NEM costs and benefits, which could be subsequently considered in a future rate proceeding," period, end quote of your quote, internally, and end quote of your testimony. Correct?
That's what it looks like, yes.
And then you cite to Mr. Gimbel's rebuttal testimony on page 2. If you follow that cite, Mr. Gimbel in that testimony is actually summarizing the division's position. Is that, are you aware of that?
I would have to reread that.
Okay, so subject to check.
If that's my misinterpretation, then I apologize.
Let's turn to some of the testimony that I had a concern about earlier. Page 12 of your sir rebuttal testimony. Here you are relying on, you discuss Ms. Stewart's contention, and you indicate that it's countered by the expert testimony of Jonathan Lesser for UIC. Do you know the constituent members of UIC?
No.
So if I told you that the members of UIC are Wholesome Inc., Kennecott Utah Copper LLC, Kimberly-Clark Corporation, Maltomeal, Praxair Inc., Procter & Gamble Inc., and Tesoro Refining and Marketing, that would be novel information?
That would be novel information to me.
In your testimony here on page 12, you were agreeing with the Kennecott-led group that the residential class are peakier than other classes in that, correct?
I'm sorry, can you point me to where again? I missed where you said.
Well, you claim that Mr. Lesser showed residential class loads are peakier in magnitude than other classes. And your contention is that that testimony counters the company's position, and you apparently are agreeing with the Kennecott-led group that with respect to the peaky nature of the residential class.
Do you mind if I read this again real quick?
Sure.
I'm not sure I remember exactly what's here. Okay, I've read it. And could you repeat the question again?
Is it your testimony that you agree with the contentions of the Kennecott-led group that with respect to the peaky nature of the residential class?
Yes.
You understand that the Kennecott-led group's intention with presenting that testimony was to shift additional costs and increase the burden above and beyond that currently borne by the residential customer class?
I was not aware of the intent of the other parties using that statement.
So, with the understanding now that the Kennecott-led group's intention is to assert, as you state, that the summer peak is the driving factor for capacity additions, and that the end result of that is to shift additional cost burden to the residential customer class, your testimony is that you agree with those positions.
Objection. The question assumes facts, not in evidence, regarding UIEC's intention. That was counsel's assertion of what their intention was, but that's not in the record.
I believe it is in the record. I believe that UIEC's testimony with respect to cost of service is clear in their position with respect to the cost allocation and the purpose behind their testimony.
Would you answer the question, please?
If the
objection's overruled.
Could you repeat it one more time? I'm sorry, I just want to make sure I understand the question completely.
Your testimony is that you agree with Mr. Brubaker and Lesser that the summer peak is the driving factor for capacity additions. That's
yes,
your testimony.
That's correct.
And the record demonstrates that the Kennecott-led group's purpose behind making that assertion is to shift additional cost burden to the residential class from the Kennecott-led group, the UIEC group. Do you understand that?
I understand that now.
So if the Sierra Club and the Kennecott-led group were successful in their assertions here, the end result would be, would it not, under the cost of service analysis, that the residential customer class would be burdened with additional costs above and beyond what they bear now in a cost of service study?
I don't know how to assess that right now without the information.
Are you aware that the company's cost of service study that they presented was based on a 12 CP?
No. I'm sorry, could you repeat that again? I'm not sure I understood that.
The company's cost of service study was based on 12 CP. Are you aware of that?
No.
Do you understand what that means?
No. That last part, what do you mean by that last statement, that cost CP?
The 12 coincident peak analysis method.
Okay, yes.
Are you aware of
that? I've heard of that, yes.
So if the CP value was reduced from 12 to a summer peak of 1 or something akin to 1, and your assertion and that of the Kennecott-led group was that summer peak was the driving factor for capacity additions, the end result under the cost of service would be an additional burden of cost shifted to the residential customers, correct?
If that's the way the analysis works, then.
And then the result of your analysis indicating that there are benefits of over $1 million would result in the ability of net metering customers to avoid those additional cost burdens that are shifted through this position propounded by you and the Kennecott-led group, correct?
I'm not saying that the net metering customers necessarily avoid. I'm saying these are avoided costs to the entire system.
That would be a benefit that your intention or contention would be should be attributed to the net metering customers.
What do you mean by that?
The benefits that you calculated, the mm-hmm. $1+ million worth of benefits, is it your contention that the reward for those benefits should be assigned or allocated to net metering customers as opposed to the larger class of residential customers?
No, these are avoided costs borne by the system as a whole, which would lead to a reduced rates across the board in some manner.
I have no further questions.
Zetti?
Thank you. I have no questions.
Mr. Plank?
No questions. Commissioner Clark?
No, thank you. Says. Any redirect, Ms. Roberts?
I do have a few questions. Thank you. If I may approach the witness, I'd like to provide him with a copy of Mr. Gimbel's testimony that he had cited to, that the office has said that he was misinterpreting. May I? This is page 2 of Gimbel's direct.
You may approach.
I'm sorry, his rebuttal. Mr. Gimbel's rebuttal testimony. Dr. Mulvaney, could you read what is on lines 45 to 47 of Mr. Gimbel's rebuttal testimony?
Starting after the comma. That sound okay?
Wherever you feel like provides the appropriate context is fine.
Okay. The office agrees with the division's process recommendation to open a separate docket to consider NM, which I presume to be net metering, cost-benefit issues associated with SB 208.
Okay. So that position was shared by the office and the division at that time?
That's what I understood when I originally read this testimony, but I would have to read the whole thing again.
Thank you very much. I have no further redirect. Thank you.
Questions by the commission? I have one or two, perhaps. A good jumping off point would be pages 3 and 4 of your SIR rebuttal, Dr. Okay. Mulvaney. A sentence that you've already discussed with counsel. Starting on just the last couple of words of line 18 and then over on to page 4.
Okay.
The full evaluation of costs and benefits, and you use that phrase in this sentence, mm-hmm. That phrase as you contemplate it, is that an evaluation of the costs and benefits associated with the residential class generally or solely net metering customers?
I believe the cost and benefit analysis would look at the impact of the net metering customers on the system as a whole. So kind of both, if that makes sense.
So the rate design changes that you described in your summary, are you contemplating that rate structure changes would be necessary for the entire residential class in order to complete a proper analysis and application of that analysis?
I don't think so. It depends on what I actually don't know. I'm not sure. I'm sorry, I haven't thought beyond the cost and benefit analysis.
That's great. I think I read something into your summary that wasn't there, and so I don't think I need to ask any further questions about this sentence.
Okay.
Any redirect, Ms. Roberts, or any follow-up questions based on mine?
I wanted to offer that we could submit a written version of Dr. Mulvaney's summary if you wanted to revisit the issue that you
That's fine. We'll have it in the transcript. That's fine. Thank you very much. So, you're excused, Dr. Mulvaney. Thank you
very much.
Ms. Hayes.
Thank you, Commissioner Clark. Utah Clean Energy will call Sarah Wright, who needs to be sworn.
Thank you. Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Ms. Wright, will you please state your name, position, and business address for the record?
Excuse me. Yes, my name is Sarah Wright. I'm the Executive Director of Utah Clean Energy. My business address is 1014 2nd Avenue, Salt Lake City, Utah, 84103.
Thank you. Did you file direct rebuttal and surrebuttal testimony in this phase of the proceeding along with one exhibit to your direct testimony?
Yes, I did.
If I asked you the same question set forth therein, would your answers today be the same?
Yes.
I would now move the admission of the testimony and exhibit of Sarah Wright.
Objections? They're received.
Ms. Wright, do you have a summary you'd like to present?
Yes.
Please proceed.
Well, I'd like to thank the Commission for the opportunity to summarize my testimony on the issue of customer-sided resource, such as demand-side distributed generation and the company's proposed net metering charge. I also include some information about rate design, which is relevant to some of the discussions here that was also in my testimony. Utah Clean Energy is a nonprofit public interest group. We strive to create a more efficient, cleaner, and smarter energy future. Our goal is to transition in the most economic way possible. My testimony covered three main points. The first is that the world is changing. It's much different than it was when we started regulating electricity nearly 100 years ago. And increasingly, customer-sided the meter investments in energy efficiency, demand response, and distributed generation have the opportunity to bring value and reduce risk for all ratepayers. It's critical that we take proper care and diligence to appropriately analyze and value customer side of the meter investments. And indeed, our legislature in 2008 and again in 2014 directed the commission to consider the cost and benefits of rooftop solar with the opportunity for public comment prior to implementing a fee, credit, or other just and reasonable rate design for rooftop solar customers. Leveraging private investments in pollution-free and fuel-free resources and energy efficiency is an extremely costly way to mitigate risk while reducing the need for rate-based resources. It's my opinion that it is not in ratepayers' interest to implement a rate design that could undermine lower cost, risk mitigating resources that benefit all ratepayers and that customers acquire in large part at their own personal expense prior to exploring both the costs and the benefits that these resources bring to the system and ratepayers. In a recent regulatory assistance project report, Designing Distributed Generation Tariffs Well, Fair Compensation in a Time of Transition, and we are in a time of transition now, they make the important point that customer-sided choices, energy efficiency, demand response, and customer-sided generation will be a cornerstone of our electricity system in the future. They further make the case that failure to recognize the benefits and to compensate customers for the value that these services provide will impede their maturation, lead to unnecessary investment in redundant resources, and thus impose unnecessary costs to all electricity customers. Although the company says that they don't need new resources until 2027 or later, that the market will be there, I don't speculate in my testimony how the market might change with EPA's proposed carbon rules, and we're not sure what the 2015 IRP will call for. But to be clear, we're not just talking about generation resources. The company has already invested billions in transmission and in coal plant upgrades. If we take our demand-side management and demand response programs and couple them with solar and going forward with new technologies, such as smart thermostats that are already on the market, efficient and smart appliances, smart inverters, storage, electric vehicles, and continue to grow the company's award-winning DSM programs and demand response programs, we can create a cleaner, lower-risk portfolio for the benefit of all ratepayers, and indeed for the benefit of Utah and Utah families and Utah businesses. But further, RAP acknowledges that the grid will continue to provide important services and that we need to ensure that the utility is adequately compensated. And Rich Walgie clearly acknowledged that efficiency has already changed demand for the company's product, and that their cost recovery in the residential class can be dependent on weather. And we agree. As we move forward and we move toward more customer side of the meter resources, efficiency, demand response, and distributed renewables, under the current rate recovery paradigm, for the residential class, it will be harder for the company to recover these costs. And in my testimony, I suggest that we look at this issue and other rate-making issues for the entire residential class, not just the small subset of net metered customers, to look at how we can encourage the types of customer behaviors and customer investments that will serve to clean and de-risk our portfolio, reduce peak demand, reduce needed company investments while keeping rates just and reasonable, and also while ensuring that the company is fairly compensated for the important services that they provide. The cost that the company calculated for these net metered customers was based solely on lost revenues from the solar customers, not on the actual costs that those customers impose on the system. And we look at the lost revenues from DSM programs, they dwarf those from Utah's nascent solar market. We have time to get this right, is my second point. Both the 2008 net metering statute that was in place when the rate case was filed in 2014, and the 2014 net metering statute have a threshold requirement to determine whether costs outweigh the benefits or vice versa, with the opportunity for public comments before the Public Service Commission determines whether a fee or credit is justified. I appreciate that solar is growing, and I'm excited by that prospect. But we have a very low penetration of solar in Utah, approximately 0.3% of residential customers will have solar in the forecast year. And that on average, these customers still use 74% of the average customer's use. This low penetration and the fact that these customers still rely on the grid for most of their energy indicates that we have time for a more thorough investigation and transparent cost-benefit analysis prior to implementing a fee. And finally, perhaps my most important point is that it's Utah Clean Energy's position that there is insufficient evidence on the record, an insufficient opportunity for stakeholder input to make a determination on whether the costs outweigh the benefits or whether the benefits outweigh the cost, and to determine a just and reasonable fee, credit, or rate-making structure. In Utah Clean Energy's direct testimony, we presented a value of solar study conducted by a respected firm, Clean Power Research, using Utah and IRP-specific data. CPR used its DG Valuator V2 platform to perform this study, a tool that models hourly PV production, calculates line losses and loss savings, and determines value components based on user input data. Clean Power Research has conducted similar analysis in a number of states. The CPR analysis showed a levelized distributed solar PV value of 11.6 cents per kilowatt hour. Inputs for the study reflect RMP's system. Inputs included RMP's 2012 hourly load data, and from the IRP, generation and capital cost, years until a new resource needed to be added, which was 11 at the time, fuel cost, heat rates, reserve margins, and discount rate. We included the middle case CO2 cost from the IRP. No other environmental costs were added to this analysis. And if you look at the findings from the environmental benefits section of this analysis, it was the smallest value stream. In my testimony, I also noted another indicator was that solar has a value to ratepayers. In Pacific Horse 2013 IRP modeling using the system optimizer model, it selected every bit of solar that it was allowed to select, up to 300 megawatts. And it selected those under every single scenario: low-cost gas, high-cost gas, zero carbon, medium carbon, high carbon. The model selected distributed generation as a valuable resource that mitigated risk and went towards the least cost portfolio. The company did not file their interpretation of the benefits of solar until their rebuttal testimony, nearly 6 months after their initial filing, and only 3 weeks before final rebuttal was due. even though both the 2008 net metering statute and the revised 2014 statute call for a cost-benefit look. It has not been Utah Clean Energy's position that the commission should take our findings. Our position is that with stakeholder input and analysis, it is not our position that the commission should just take our findings carte blanche, but rather the findings indicate that there is evidence to suggest that solar has value. It has value to ratepayers and that further analysis is necessary. In our direct testimony and throughout this docket, Utah Clean Energy has been advocating for an open, transparent analysis of the cost and benefits of solar before implementing a fee or credit. The analysis must include both residential and non-residential net metering customers as a whole, as considered by the legislature. I appreciate the office's recommendation for a commission process for evaluating net metering and support their recommendations, particularly with allowing sufficient time for parties to explore areas of agreement relating to modeling components, inputs, and assumption. I agree that a collaborative stakeholder process would help parties focus on particular issues prior to filing testimony, and I make the following additional process recommendations. I believe there should be neutral process facilitation, that the analysis should be done by third party, and that technical conference with experts in solar evaluation, utility issues, or any issues that are relevant to this analysis should be part so that there is full understanding among all parties. And I appreciate the commission looking at this, and that concludes my summary. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wright. Ms. Wright is available for cross-examination.
Ms. Hogle.
Hi, Ms. Wright. I have just a few questions to ask you. First, I want to ask you about something you said in your opening. You testified that you don't think the public has had the opportunity to comment in this case. There have been 7 months between the time that the company filed its application in this case with the proposed net metering charge up to date, right? It's been 7 months. You don't think that's enough opportunity for the public to comment on that?
Well, they certainly didn't have very much opportunity to comment on your proposed value that you put forth in. So a cost-benefit analysis looks both at the costs and the benefits. And you put forth your analysis of the cost, and then 6 months later, 3 weeks before the end of this proceeding, you presented what you considered the value to be.
Fair enough.
3 weeks, so I do believe that is not sufficient.
Fair enough. And just to be clear, the company, the commission did not issue its notice until April, correct?
Well, the 2008 statute called for a cost-benefit analysis, so it's not like the new statute, it wasn't called. It was in the previous statute, and so I'm not an attorney, but there was a whole discussion about the burden of proof.
Thank
yesterday,
you.
So I don't want to go there.
That was another point of my cross-examination, actually, that you brought up about the 2008 docket. You participated in that docket, correct?
Yes, I did.
And isn't it true that in that docket?
Which docket? I apologize.
It's in the 2008 net metering docket.
It was a rulemaking.
That you referenced.
Well, I'm talking about the 2008 statute. The net metering statute was revised in 2008, and the legislature included a requirement of looking at the cost, not imposing a fee until there was a cost benefit, until it was shown that, I'm sorry, I don't have it in front of me, but it said something to effect that, very similar to the language that we have on the record now, that there needed to be a cost benefit analysis. So this isn't a new requirement in 2014. This is a requirement that's been in statute since 2008. It's just been tweaked a little bit in 2014.
Did you participate in the docket where the benefit to the net metering customer changed from avoided costs to the full retail rate?
I'm trying to remember if that was a docket or rulemaking, but yes,
that
was
that?
Part of it. I don't recall. I mean, I don't have the details.
Would you just let me know the docket number?
I think she acknowledges that she remembers it.
I mean, I don't remember the details.
Yes.
But
I don't.
There was a rulemaking or something. There was a commission proceeding, and there was also a proceeding on interconnection standards
okay.
that lasted about 2 years.
Isn't it true that in that docket, in that proceeding, and you participated in that, I believe, Utah Clean Energy acknowledged that a full cost-benefit analysis had not been undertaken, yet you supported a change from the avoided cost to the full retail rate. Is that correct?
In that docket, the legislation in 2008 didn't require a full cost-benefit analysis to not impose a fee. It required a cost-benefit analysis to impose a fee. So the burden of proof was a little bit switched, and I don't know if we have a copy. Oh, I do have a copy of the language in my testimony from the 2008, what it said. Would you like me to find that?
That's okay. Thank you. Thank you. You also talked a little bit about the study that was attached to your testimony in this case, correct?
Yes.
I'm going to take you back to another case that has been referenced here numerous times. Did you present testimony to this commission in the avoided cost docket?
Yes, I did.
And in that testimony, you urged this commission to consider capacity values of renewable resources and for risk mitigating effects such resources have on fuel price volatility and environmental compliance costs to determine avoided costs for QF solar. Is that true?
This was a docket on wholesale sale of electricity under the PURPA statute. It did not mention distributed generation. So just with that caveat.
Sure.
And it had no look at distributed generation.
Okay.
We did, and I also seem to remember that the commission said that those things were included in the IRP values. So first of all, it's not my position that if I could get 3% power delivered to my household, I would be thrilled.
Okay. In its order, the commission rejected your recommendations. Would you agree to that?
For QF wholesale of electricity.
Yes. Now, let's go back to the clean power research study that you attached to your direct testimony.
Would it be helpful if I refer to it?
Sure. I think you'll know this even without referencing it, but you didn't author that study. Is that right?
No, we used a respected firm.
And in that study, clean power research included in its value of solar, avoided environmental costs and fuel price guarantee values, right?
They included the middle cost case from the IRP, and they did include a fuel price guarantee value.
And those factors were the same factors that this commission concluded in the avoided cost docket were too speculative to consider with respect to coming up with avoided cost prices.
I'll say two things. One, I think we discussed yesterday that there wasn't enough evidence on the record. And secondly, as I stated in my summary, we're not putting this forth as the gospel truth, as Rick said. We're putting it forth that these resources have value. And we also, our whole thing is transitioning to a cleaner system, risk-free system, as economically as possible. And these are zero-cost resources for the company, so I think they are in the interest of ratepayers.
Ms. Wright.
And it's worth evaluation.
I completely understand your position. Do you know if in the finding of, in the commission's order in that avoided cost docket, with respect to the finding that the environmental risk factors, including costs associated with adapting to changing climate, was based on the fact that there wasn't sufficient evidence or was based on the fact that they were divergent and speculative projections?
Well, I don't recall, but I didn't use the cost of adjusting to climate here. I used a carbon regulation cost the company uses in its IRP to determine the least cost, least risk portfolio.
Okay. Would you like me to show you where the commission made its findings so you can see or answer the question?
I thought you were talking about the fuel hedging value when you asked me that question. The environmental costs that are included are in this. I mean, I would love to say that we should include all the costs associated with climate change. They have been projected to be quite large. I'm not proposing that here.
Thank you. Let me just ask you one more line of questioning, if that's okay.
Of course.
Now, you were in the room when Mr. Gilliam and others testified about the issue with excess solar production or export. I mean, do you remember that sort of discussion in general?
In general, of course, I was here.
Okay. Do you share any of those concerns that were voiced by him and Mr. Rossetti?
If you want to ask me which concern, I can respond to them.
Sure. One of the things that Mr. Gilliam in his direct testimony states is that the commission's net metering focus should be limited to solar generation that leaves the retail customer's premises or is exported. Do you recall that? That leaves the retail customer's premises, i.e. is exported.
So I can't speak to every aspect of our expert witness's testimony. I'm sorry. So what's your question? If you repeat it again, I can see if I...
Sure. Well, I was going to pose a hypothetical for you.
Please do.
Okay. Thank you. So assume a 30-day billing cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Assume further that a net metering customer consumes exactly 30 kilowatt hours from all sources.
30?
Or 900 kilowatt hours for the billing cycle. 30 days.
Oh, okay, 30 per day.
Yes.
Okay, sorry, I was like, whoa, that's an efficient customer.
Assume further that the net metering customer's generation produces, so the solar generation, self-generation, produces 50 kilowatt hours on 18 days of those 30 and 0 kilowatt hours on 12 days on the same billing cycle. So that, let me tell you what the math is.
Thanks.
Not 900 kilowatt hours.
Okay, perfect.
Okay. Would you agree that in that, under that scenario, there is no export?
Because no, I wouldn't agree.
So there's 900 kilowatt hours consumed, and the net metering customer's generation produces 50 kilowatt hours.
See, that's
18 days.
Excuse me, I understand what you're saying, Ms. Hogel, that it's net export would be, let's say I have a large load and I have 1 kilowatt system on my house, and I'm just knocking down my power a little bit. That would mean I'm never sending any to the grid because my demand is so high and the generation is so low.
Okay, well, this is my hypothetical, Ms. Wright.
Okay, but I'm just saying there would be export under your scenario.
900.
So you're just saying a wash.
Yes, a wash.
Okay, that's fine. I was confusing the export.
Okay. What would be the net metering customer? What would the net metering customer pay for the billing cycle under current Utah residential rate, assuming those facts?
Assuming those facts for that month, it would be the minimum bill payment.
And do you know how much that is?
Well, 7 going to 8.
Okay. So for this billing cycle, where the net metering customer uses the grid every day, right, generates no energy for 40% of the day in the month, the net metering customer pays $7 for all the use of the grid, the utilities operations, the maintenance, the administrative and general costs, the cost of generation, and the cost of transmission. Correct?
Well, I would say I'll start by saying that rates are based on averages in the residential class. So there are very few of those that go to zero.
Thank you.
But on average, that person would be paying $7 for that. The question that we have before us are the benefits that that system provides to the system. Do they outweigh that? That's the analysis we're asking for.
Thank you, Ms. Wright.
Thank you.
I have no further questions, Your Honor.
Mr. Jetter.
I'll try to be brief. Good afternoon,
Hello.
Ms. Wright.
Good afternoon.
You had mentioned a couple times that the distributed home solar systems are a zero-cost resource. Did you mean zero cost in total to the company or possibly zero fuel cost?
That's a really good question. So it would be whatever their generation and transmission, whatever it costs to get that energy to that feeder line would be zero.
But you would agree that if we use Ms. Hogle's example, there is a cost to Rocky Mountain Power, and essentially that would be portion to the other, in this case, residential ratepayers. There is a cost to that resource to the other ratepayers.
There is a cost to be connected to the grid.
Okay. And so in that case, the home solar system is not necessarily a zero cost to ultimately other ratepayers.
It would depend on what the values that system brings. If the system brings values, and if risk mitigation, especially when, I mean, we haven't decided what the universe of values we want to look at in this state, but if the values outweigh the costs, then it would be zero. But we haven't determined that yet.
But you, even in that example, you would say that there are certainly costs, and there may be benefits that are greater or less than the costs.
And I fully acknowledge in my summary that the grid is not free.
Okay.
And that the company and ratepayers and rates should be just and reasonable.
Okay. Thank you. That's all the questions that I had. Thank you, Ms. Wright.
Thank you.
Mr. Coleman.
I have one brief line. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
In your summary, you indicated, you testified that the fee, that your position is the fee was based on lost revenue.
Remember, that is how the company calculated based on that the average net metered customer uses, I don't know, 100 and whatever less than the typical customer. That's how they calculated the costs.
And you understand, I mean, you've participated in the docket from the outset, correct?
Correct.
And you participated in the discussions that led to the partial resolution of the issues.
No, we were actually excluded from many of those discussions. I was at one of them, I think, maybe two, but we were excluded from those discussions.
You understand that the revenue requirement in this case has been set?
Yes.
And you understand that the resolution of yesterday and today's proceedings won't change the revenue requirement in any way?
I understand.
And so you also understand that the revenue requirement allocation to the residential class is also set.
Yes.
And so the underlying issue is what part or what constituent components, members of the residential class are going to pay the residential class revenue requirement allocation, correct? That's what we're talking about.
Yes.
I have no further questions.
I have no questions. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Plank?
No questions, Commissioner. Thank you.
Ms. Roberts?
Club has no questions.
Redirect?
Excuse me. I have no redirect.
Thank you.
You're
excused.
Thank you.
Are there other matters to come before the commission before we recess until we begin the public witness portion of the hearing at 5:00?
Yes,
Ms.
Your
Hogle.
Honor. Thank you. I just wanted to make sure to remind you that to consider or to keep in mind that the revenue requirement settlement, I believe, has two different scenarios on whether or not the 465 applies, and just that needs to be taken into consideration when you issue your order. And so just to be clear that you'll rule on that.
Thank you. We intend to do so, and appreciate your attention to that. Anything else?
Commissioner Clark, I have a question for the commission. Mm-hmm. Throughout the proceedings, in fact, in the pre-file testimony, there's been numerous instances where the parties have tried to dance around the issue of parties opining as to legal conclusions and objections made and statements offered. And again, as we just heard from the last witness, whether it's burden of proof, old statute, new statute, the 09 DSM order from this commission, the 2013 QF order. I'm wondering if it would be helpful to the commission if the parties, those that wanted to, it'd be a voluntary application just like testimony, filed a legal brief. And I'm thinking of something short and to come in, you know, in a short order, limited to those legal topics, because it's been apparent to me throughout these proceedings that there's not necessarily consistent agreement among all the parties on those legal issues, much less the factual issues before the commission. And so I was going to ask the commission if it would be helpful. The kind of thing that I had in mind, I would indicate if we had a due date of about August 8th, that would give the commission 3 full weeks before the due date of the order to have those. I'm thinking of something that would be simultaneously filed by all parties, meaning no rebuttal to each other or anything else. And if a party doesn't want to, they're not required to. In any event, that's my question, is if it wouldn't be helpful to the commission to have some limited briefing on just those matters of law.
Does any other party want to express a view on that proposal?
Sierra Club was going to make the same recommendation, so I would agree.
I would just say that an August 8 deadline would tend to be more beneficial to large organizations with more than one attorney.
Other comments? Mr. Coleman?
No, I think the office would do their best. I'm not sure it's necessary, and I think the commission is well versed in its history and its decision making processes. But the office would.
I would concur with the office.
We'll do what we're asked to do. Or maybe take advantage of the opportunity if we feel necessary. But it might be duplicative with respect to the commission's expertise.
Do you want to recess to consider that? We'll be in recess. Appreciate the proposal. We're going to discuss it for a couple of minutes. And I think this will not take long. I didn't apologize for the delay that we imposed on you all the last time, but you put some hard questions to us. So would you mind? We'll be in recess for about 2 or 3 minutes, and we'll be back to you. Thank you.